The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 24, 2023, bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow inner border in white. It still features that upper right-hand thumbprint space that says our 100th year. Time is in large white block lettering superimposed upon white to gray clouds to blue sky, and that time is overlooking what may be a farm or conglomerate of buildings or plantation. It's very green in the foreground, the middle ground, and the background, except for the blue sky and gray clouds hovering above it. There are palm trees in the background. There are utility poles in the middle foreground. There are tall plants, so tall I don't know what to call them except possibly palmetto. There are deciduous trees bordering this structure that is at least two stories tall, but it looks kind of grungy. It's white with a lot of either rust or decay in a rusty brown-red coloration. It has a red tile roof. There are smaller outbuildings actually in front of it. They could be garages. They could be wash houses. They could be small barns such as chicken coops. The caption reads, "Slavery reparations are coming." Moving, however, to the brief. This is entitled Hunter Biden Headache by Eric Cortalesa. House Republicans plan to ramp up their investigation into the president's son after whistleblower testimony. On a white background, there are two male figures in profile. Actually, we see just their heads, their white shirts, and blue ties. One is definitely President Joe Biden with his close-shorn white hair and his aviator sunglasses. Next to him is a younger individual with salt and pepper gray hair, I suppose one would say, and some gray facial hair. I personally do not know if that's Hunter Biden or not because I'm not seeing a specific caption. But Eric Cortalesa writes, Hunter Biden headache. After the Justice Department announced June 20, Hunter Biden had reached a plea deal on misdemeanor tax charges, Republicans in Congress made clear they were not done with the president's son. The emergence of an Internal Revenue Service whistleblower alleging that the younger Biden received special treatment from federal prosecutors lit a fire under House Republicans, who accelerated an investigation that could stretch into 2024. According to sources familiar with the matter, House GOP leadership intends to wait for Hunter Biden's July arraignment before moving ahead with a multi-pronged investigatory effort spearheaded by three committees, Judiciary, Oversight, Ways and Means. The panels are pursuing a thorough investigation into this misconduct to deliver the transparency and accountability that the American people demand and deserve. Their chairs, Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio, James Comer of Kentucky, and Jason Smith of Missouri said in a statement. The new phase of the inquiry stems from testimony provided to the Ways and Means Committee by Gary Shapley, an IRS official who supervised the agency's role in the DOJ investigation. Asserting whistleblower protections, he claimed Attorney General Merrick Garland prevented the Trump-appointed U.S. attorney overseeing the probe from bringing more charges against Joe Biden's son. Both Garland and the prosecutor, David Weiss, have strenuously denied allegations, and the DOJ said when announcing the agreement, without elaboration, that the investigation is ongoing. Sources say House Republicans are likely to call Weiss to testify on the matter in the coming months. Shapley, a 14-year IRS employee, also told lawmakers the Justice Department denied requests from prosecutors to examine text messages in which Hunter Biden allegedly used his father as leverage to pressure a Chinese company to pay him. I'm sitting here with my father, and we would like to understand why the commitment has not been fulfilled, Hunter Biden texted the CEO of a Chinese fund management company in 2017, according to testimony from Shapley. Joe Biden told reporters he was not with his son during the exchange 6 years ago. Since assuming a slim majority in January, House Republicans have put investigating malfeasance related to Hunter Biden at the top of their agenda, but have so far failed to deliver anything that incriminates the president. At the very least, this latest turn in the investigation allows them to hunt for evidence to determine whether Garland's or Shapley's account is true. This is just typical presidential year political theater and not serious oversight work, says a former Democratic congressional investigative counsel who requested anonymity because they still work with the government. The more media attention that a whistleblower seeks, in my experience, the less credible they have typically been. It is an argument shared by other Capitol veterans, including Ronald Wyeth, former Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs and Chief Counsel to former Senators Harry Reid and Ted Kennedy. Running to Congress should not be the first avenue for a whistleblower, says Weich, now the Dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, emphasizing Shapley could have turned to the Inspector General of either the Treasury or Justice Department, and Congress should not be interfering in ongoing criminal investigations or prosecutions. I think the fact that he went to Congress suggests this has more of a political motive. Another former high-level government official also expressed skepticism over the complaints. Whistleblowers frequently have agendas that explain their coming forward. Sometimes the agendas are personal. In this day and age, they're increasingly political, says Michael Bromwich, a former federal prosecutor and Department of Justice Inspector General during the Clinton administration. Whistleblowers should not be dismissed out of hand, but their allegations also should not be treated as the gospel truth until fully vetted and tested. House Republicans have been citing Shapley's testimony as grounds to pursue impeachment proceedings against Garland, an idea promoted by the likes of right-wing firebrands Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. June 25, Speaker Kevin McCarthy signaled a willingness to consider it. He tweeted, "If the whistleblower's allegations are true, this will be a significant part of a larger impeachment inquiry into Merrick Garland's weaponization of DOJ." Democrats expect the forthcoming proceedings to amount to more of a stunt than a serious investigation into alleged wrongdoing. Merrick Garland has a pretty long track record, says the former congressional counsel. I find it pretty implausible that he would stake his career on trying to protect Hunter Biden. Day Trees of Destruction in the West Bank. Mainly, this is a photograph, shows a brick wall, the brick wall of a building, an open door with two people. There's a man seated on the stoop, it's one step up, and a woman behind him. They're dressed in black, except she has a rose-colored headscarf wrapped around her head and shoulders. On either side of the door, in a triangular fashion, are flower pots attached to that brick wall. 4, 7, 10 on either side of the doorway. And in front of the brick wall with the flower pots and the people in the doorway is a lot of concrete, rebar, rubble. The caption reads, Palestinians survey rubble in the Jenin refugee camp, July 5. After Israeli troops conducted one of the largest West Bank military operations in recent years, more than 1,000 soldiers raided the camp, considered a militant stronghold, in what Israeli officials deemed a counterterrorism operation. At least 12 Palestinians were killed, and around 100 others injured. The Bulletin. What extreme heat means for Hajj pilgrims. This is by Armani Syed. Some 1.8 million Muslims descended on Mecca, Saudi Arabia, from June 26 to July 1 to perform Hajj. That's H-A-J-J. Compared with caps of 10,000 pilgrims in 2020, 60,000 in 2021, and 1 million in 2022, it was the biggest Hajj in years after Saudi officials established strict COVID-19 travel limits. But with the influx of pilgrims, the kingdom billed this year's Hajj as the largest in history, came a reminder of a long-standing health concern that has loomed over it: extreme heat, too hot to handle. At least 8,400 pilgrims were treated for heat stroke or exhaustion, with temperatures regularly topping 111 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the week. The Islamic holiday follows the lunar calendar, meaning that the timing of Hajj changes each year, but it will continue to fall in Saudi Arabia's hottest months until 2026. Pilgrims at the Grand Mosque were sprayed with water via automatic cooling systems, and free bottles of water and umbrellas were distributed. More than 32,000 health workers, as well as thousands of ambulances, were on standby to treat cases of heat stroke, dehydration, and exhaustion. The government of Saudi Arabia, for all their flaws, takes their duty as hosts very seriously, says Yara Asi, assistant professor at the University of Central Florida's School of Global Health Management and Informatics. This is supposed to be a holy time, a gathering of global Muslims, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. They want it to go well. Extreme heat is not automatically attributable to climate change because it is a desert, says Joss Lilleveld, professor at the Max Planck Institute for the Advancement of Science. But Lilleveld says studies show the Gulf is getting hotter. For example, according to Yale Climate Connections, wet bulb temperatures, which measure a combination of dry air and humidity that makes it hard for bodies to cool down, are about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit higher on average in Mecca than they were three decades ago. The worry for pilgrims and Saudi officials alike is that rising temperatures will get in the way of one of the five pillars of Islam, and only more so over time. At some point, Asi warns, we may see a decrease in the vulnerable populations traveling to Hajj. The brief news, good question. What is behind the homelessness crisis? By Belinda Luscom and Elijah Wolfson. People do not usually become homeless suddenly. It is a chutes and ladders process with lots of chutes and hardly any ladders. A large new statewide study done by the University of California, San Francisco's Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative takes a closer look at the period just before homelessness by asking a representative sample of almost 3,200 homeless people from all over the state about the chutes they fell into and what would have helped. Mark and Lynn Benioff, B-E-N-I-O-F-F, funders of the UCSF initiative, are also co-chairs and owners of Time. The study, published June 20, is the largest of its kind since the 1990s. Some of the findings were unsurprising. In the state with the nation's largest homeless population, people are unhoused because they don't have enough money or have endured trauma. A quarter of all survey participants had experienced sexual violence, and their lives and health and safety get much worse once homelessness strikes. But some of the report's data run counter to popular perception. For example, most homeless people were not from out of state, contrary to the myth that homeless people move to California for the weather and policies. The median length of homelessness at the time of the survey was nearly 2 years. The study's lead author, Dr. Margot Kuschel, professor of medicine at UCSF, says there is a doom loop of homelessness, where people have jobs that do not cover living expenses, so they lose their homes, and the resulting instability makes it harder to keep their jobs. She points to really exciting models of homelessness prevention, where in low-income communities they will have subway and bus posters saying, "Are you at risk of becoming homeless? Call us." These programs might offer anything from infusions of cash to mediation services with landlords or roommates. What was really striking to us was how little money people thought it would have taken, says Kuschel. Most participants suggested that less than $500 a month or a one-time payment of $10,000 would have kept them housed. The prevalence of mental illness and substance use among those experiencing homelessness is clear, but Kuschel's cautions the vast majority of mental health issues among the study participants are anxiety and depression. It is likely the lack of resources exacerbates those conditions rather than the illness causing the homelessness, she says. The driving issue is clearly the deep poverty, Kuschel says. There are four charts that reveal the study's new findings about how people slide into homelessness. The first features four circles. I'll try to explain these. They are visual. Share of Californian homeless population that reports having ever, first circle, large, suffered from a mental health condition, 82%. Next circle, these are left to right, smaller, 27% have been hospitalized for a mental health condition. Medium large circle, next, 62% have been a heavy drinker. And just slightly larger than that, in the fourth circle, 65% regularly used illicit drugs. The next graph is a bar graph in vertical alignment, where homeless Californians sought help before being evicted. Again, I'm reading left to right. This is a very short bar, 3%. Went to legal services, a little taller bar, 8%, went to a government agency. Twice as tall, 16%, went to a community-based organization or nonprofit. Slightly taller than that, 22% went to friends or family. The tallest of the six bars on this graph, 64%, did not seek help. And a very short bar, not quite as short as the first, but this sixth bar is 4% of other. And I'll read the third of the four graphs to you. This is a donut graph. And the donut is split into three segments. The last place people in California lived before becoming homeless. Almost half of the donut, 49%, was in a housing situation where they did not have their name on a lease or mortgage. Almost a third of the donut, 32%, people lived in a housing situation where they had their name on a lease or a mortgage. And the smallest percentage of the donut, 19%, was an institution such as a prison or prolonged jail stay. Another bar graph then, the main reasons respondents said they left their last residence. These bars are horizontal. I'll read from top to bottom, the largest percentage to the least percentage. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 bars are represented in this graph. The main reason the respondents said they left their last residence, 12% lost all or some income. 9% said a conflict among residents. 7% wanted own space to avoid imposing, and another 7% conflict with landlord or owner. 6% illness or death in household. Another 6% change of ownership. 5% violence or abuse in home. 4% breakup. Another 4% own substance use or drinking. And another 4% asked or encouraged to leave. Oh, here are the milestones, the milestone page. We have imploded, reported, extended, released, decreased, reached, and died. Beginning with died, and there's a photograph of this individual. He has a bald head. He's wearing a blue striped, it's more of a window pane plaid, sport coat and a white shirt. Alan Arkin, Oscar-winning actor at 89, June 29. His career spanned films like Little Miss Sunshine, television, and stage. Reached a $10.3 billion settlement over PFAS, Forever Chemicals. This is being referred to as PFAS on some media outlets. In drinking water by the company 3M, the biggest settlement ever against a PFAS manufacturer. The chemicals have been linked to negative health effects. Decreased the official age of South Koreans, June 28, after the country retired a traditional age-counting system that considered people to be 1 year old at birth. Released Smallville actor Allison Mack from prison July 3 after pleading guilty to her role in a sex trafficking case tied to a cult-like group called NXIVM. Extended NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg's term for another year, the military alliance announced July 4. Reported the first cases of local malaria transmission in the U.S. in 2 decades by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, June 26. At least 5 people have been infected in the past 2 months in Florida and Texas. And finally, imploded. This is actually about half a page and two columns by Simone Shaw. There's a photo here. It's aquatic. The caption reads, "The Ocean Gate Titan submersible imploded June 18 on a deep sea dive to the Titanic." Well, it looks like a miniature submarine. It looks metallic. It has some white paint. It has its name, Ocean Gate Titan, in blue toward the fin. It has some other contraptions wrapped around it. It almost looks like it's mounted on a toboggan or something like that. But it is shown intact in the water. Titan submersible, five lives lost on the Ocean Gate craft. Five people aboard Ocean Gate's Titan submersible perished when the craft imploded on a dive to see the Titanic. The crew's disappearance and the voyage's reported $250,000 ticket price captivated the world after the sub went missing June 18, shortly after venturing down to tour the Titanic wreckage 2.5 miles beneath the water's surface. The vessel carried Ocean Gate CEO Stockton Rush, British Pakistani businessman Shahzada Dawood, and his teenage son Suleiman Dawood, British explorer Hamish Harding, and French Titanic expert Paul-Henri Nargiolet. The vessel reportedly imploded an hour and 45 minutes into the dive, instantly killing those on board. Presumed human remains have been found within the submersible's debris, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. Experts say the sub's landing frame and a rear cover were also recovered following the search's conclusion June 22. The disaster with Ocean Gate, which began taking tourists on Titanic tours in 2021, shines a harsh spotlight on the growing and largely unregulated deep sea tourism industry. Deep sea excursions rarely face government interference, experts say, and Ocean Gate's Titan did not meet the classification standards or go through the independent certification process usually required of ocean vessels. When asked in 2022 about the safety of the Titan submersible, Rush told CBS, "If you just want to be safe, don't get out of bed." Some hope the Titan implosion could spur change. The government won't regulate until there's a demonstrated need. That industry has failed to self-regulate, says John Heschke, associate professor at Thompson Rivers University in British Columbia. However, if there are particular high-profile incidents, then that becomes the business of the government to regulate. For now, the families are left with questions and their grief. It's been crippling, to be honest. I personally have found it kind of difficult to breathe thinking of them, said Osme Dawood, or Dawood, the sister of Shahzada Dawood and aunt of Suleiman Dawood. The family of British adventurer Harding wrote in a statement that he was a passionate explorer, and that if we can take any small consolation from this tragedy, it is that we lost him doing what he loved. Turning the page to the brief health. Four Ways to Get That Vacation Feeling in 2 Days by Angela Haupt. Going on vacation every week might sound like the very unattainable dream, but a simple mindset shift can make it happen, no travel involved. All you need to do is get in the habit of treating your weekend like a vacation, suggests Cassie Mogilner-Holmes, professor at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. A few years ago, Holmes and her colleagues began exploring the importance of taking vacations, which are correlated with improved health, creativity, job performance, and life satisfaction. Yet only 48% of U.S. workers use all their vacation days, according to a recent survey by the Pew Research Center. Initially, we were like, how do we get more people to take their vacations? Holmes says, but then we realized we actually have breaks in our lives already. Presenting the weekend. In a series of experiments, Holmes' team instructed 441 U.S. workers to either spend the weekend like they would any other, or treat it like a vacation. When they were back at work Monday, people who had adopted a vacation mindset reported being happier, less stressed and worried, and more satisfied than those who had had a regular weekend. What was somewhat surprising is that the effect was not driven by people spending their time all that differently, Holmes says. It was this mindset that allowed them to be more present. Instead of being in doing it mode, it allowed people to settle in and be in the moment. We asked experts to share their favorite tips for adopting a vacation mindset at home. 1. Get creative about making time. Not everyone has Saturday and Sunday or any two consecutive days off work, and some people are beholden to weekend schedules packed with obligations. You could still apply the philosophy to, say, a Thursday evening, Holmes suggests, or designate an hour on Sunday morning for chores, but protect the rest of the weekend as your vacation time. 2. Reflect on priorities. Home in on what makes a vacation different from a regular weekend, suggests Andrea Bonior, an adjunct psychology professor at Georgetown University. Does it mean turning off your email notifications, splurging a little? Maybe it means being able to spend time with people you do not normally get to see, or giving yourself a break on a workout, she says. It is helpful to make a list of those things and be able to follow through. 3. Act like a tourist. Decision scientist Nika Kabiri recommends doing something totally new so you can disconnect from the same old routines governing your life. Among her favorite ideas, drive to a part of town you've never been to before. Go for a stroll. Grab lunch at the first cute cafe you see. Or take a bike or boat tour of your city. The spontaneity is what makes experiences like this feel vacation-like, Kabiri says. And 4, don't put extra pressure on yourself. Treating your weekend like a vacation does not mean it needs to be an elaborate affair. If your vacation encounters a few hitches or lasts for only a few hours, don't fret. It does not have to be all or nothing, Bonior says. Do not put pressure on yourself to have this perfect vacation. It is meant to be fun. Plus, there's always another one, just a few days away. This article looks less serious. We will see about that. It's under the heading Culture, Plastic, and Barbie. Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie try to find art in commerce. By Eliana Doctorman. There's a lot of pink on this page. Now, turning the page to the text. There is plenty to consider about Barbie, but let us not start with her feet. Perfectly arched, but not quite demi-point, the ideal position to fit into any pump. They are instantly recognizable to anyone who's ever played with the iconic doll. So, when the trailer for the upcoming live-action Barbie movie opened with a shot of star Margot Robbie stepping out of Barbie's marabou stilettos, still on tiptoes, the internet exploded. On TikTok, people attempted to mimic the viral shot with their highest heels. The Wall Street Journal interviewed a podiatrist about the physical impossibility of the moment. I need to know everything, tweeted Chrissy Teigen. Robbie has answers. The shot took 8 takes. She had to hold on to a bar to keep her feet flexed. And yes, those are her feet. I really do not like it when someone else does my hands or feet in an insert shot, she says. Playing Barbie's complicated, and not just because it requires immense calf strength. I've reported on Barbie's parent company, Mattel, for the better part of a decade and sat in on test groups with moms and their kids. Some parents say Barbie inspires their children to imagine themselves as astronauts and politicians. But others refuse to buy the doll with her tiny waist and large breasts because she set an impossible beauty standard for their daughters, a problem that precipitated major changes to the doll's look in 2016. A Barbie movie was always going to be fraught, and the studio marketing the film knows it. As the trailer posts, if you love Barbie, this movie is for you. If you hate Barbie, this movie is for you. Robbie adds, if you feel indifferent about Barbie or have not thought about Barbie in years, this movie is also for you. When it was announced in 2021 that Greta Gerwig, who directed the Oscar-nominated coming-of-age stories Lady Bird and Little Women, would helm Barbie, fans were confused, surprised, and delighted. Maybe the movie would be an idiosyncratic, subversive, even feminist take on the doll, not just a commercial for Mattel, but like Barbie, the movie's existence is an exercise in contradictions. If you're wondering whether Barbie's a satire of a toy company's capitalist ambitions, a searing indictment of the current fraught state of gender relations, a heartwarming, if occasionally cliched, tribute to girl power, or a musical spectacle filled with earworms from Nicki Minaj and Dua Lipa, the answer is yes, all of the above, and then some. It is also the most anticipated movie of the summer, if not the year, which means a lot is riding on Barbie, not just for Robbie and Gerwig, neither of whom has ever produced a movie on this scale, but also for Mattel. After a period of declining sales, a recently reinvigorated Barbie is ready for her big screen debut. Barbie's move to Hollywood is the brainchild of Mattel CEO Ynon Kreiz, who came into the job 5 years ago with a vision to leverage the company's intellectual property into a cinematic universe based on Mattel toys. Barbie will be the proof of concept when it hits theaters July 21, but first it has to go up against Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible, and Christopher Nolan, Oppenheimer, in the busiest summer movie season in years. If projections of a $55 million opening weekend prove out, it will be thanks to Barbie Mania. Anything associated with the film, a rare blockbuster catering directly to women, has been breathlessly received from paparazzi photos of Robbie and co-star Ryan Gosling as Ken, skating down Venice Beach in fluorescent spandex last summer, to a teaser that cleverly parodies 2001 A Space Odyssey. Mattel has engineered some of the hype by launching Malibu Barbie cafes and announcing partnerships with Bloomingdale's, Crocs, and Hot Topic. Other moments suggest a snowball effect. Kim Kardashian recently threw her daughter a Barbie-themed birthday party, and celebs are stepping out in hot pink designer mini dresses. Though, as Mattel executive reminds me, Barbiecore did not just happen. Whatever audiences ultimately think of Barbie, Gerwig still cannot seem to believe she got away with making this version. This movie is a goddamn miracle, she says. She calls it a surprising, spicy margarita. By the time you realize the salted rim has cayenne mixed in, it's too late. You can already taste the sweetness, and you sort of go with the spice. How did a filmmaker who's best known for thoughtful movies about women's inner lives come to write and direct a movie about a toy who has no inner life and is mostly defined by her looks? It is simple. Gerwig loves dolls. I played with dolls too long, says the 39-year-old director. I was still doing it in junior high. Kids were drinking and I was playing with dolls. Gerwig's mom was not a fan of Barbie for feminist reasons. She went through the 60s and was like, what did we do all this for? But playing with Barbies proved to be a training ground for Gerwig's job as a professional storyteller. Gerwig and her partner, the filmmaker Noah Baumbach, wrote the script under unusual circumstances. After they participated in a Barbie boot camp put on by Mattel, which began with a history lesson on Barbie inventor Ruth Handler and involved a tour of Barbie's most fabulous and regrettable fashions, the pandemic struck. Cloistered in their home in New York, the duo did not receive the typical studio notes as they drafted. We worked hard to give them their space and let them come up with what the movie was going to be, uninterrupted, without people pushing an agenda on them. Not Mattel, not Warner Brothers, not us, says Robbie, 32, whose company, Lucky Chap, produced the film. And then when I saw the script, I was like, they are never going to let us do this. This is really pushing it. So what exactly is this movie? Even with the onslaught of pink-tinged marketing, Warner Brothers has managed to keep the plot under wraps. I am not here to spoil the film, which I watched in Gerwig's temporary office, a gray space in Chelsea accessorized with a magenta Barbie doormat. But I can share that it's a fun yet self-aware romp with shades of Clueless and Legally Blonde. It is also stuffed full of ideas and occasionally overwhelmed by them. The movie is set in Barbie Land, a utopia where each Barbie has an impressive job. As Helen Mirren's narrator Riley tells us, all problems of feminism and equal rights have been solved. The Barbies have sleepovers every night during which they declare how beautiful and confident they feel. The Kens, played by Gosling and Simu Liu, among others, exist as convenient dance partners, but then Robbie's Barbie begins to think about mortality. Those arched feet go flat. Cellulite appears on her thigh. To combat these changes, she must venture into the real world with Ken, who's been feeling like a mere accessory in Barbie's dream life. The real world is, well, real. Men in suits at Mattel, led by Will Ferrell, CEO, make disingenuous speeches about female empowerment. Pre-teens dress Barbie down for wreaking havoc on their self-esteem. Both Barbie and Ken go on quests of self-discovery. And that's when things get really interesting. I won't give away Ken's story, but Gosling nearly steals the show. There's also a surprisingly balletic musical number that appears to be inspired by Grease and Singin' in the Rain, a car chase sequence, a mysterious woman in a kitchen, and a running gag about Sylvester Stallone's penchant for mink coats. And that's all before things turn philosophical. Every single actor I spoke to cited Gerwig in the sharp script as the reason they joined the film. I knew this was not going to shy away from the parts of Barbie that are more interesting, but potentially a little bit more fraught, says Hari Neff, who plays a Dr. Barbie. The contemporary history of feminism and body positivity, there are questions of how Barbie can fit into all of that. Those points proved more controversial with the corporate entities involved. Robbie Brenner, the first ever executive producer of Mattel Films and architect of its cinematic universe, told the company's top brass, "You're just going to white knuckle it the whole time." Gerwig earned the Toymaker's trust with the help of Robbie. At one point, Richard Dixon, COO and president of Mattel, says he took a flight to the London set to argue with Gerwig and Robbie over a particular scene, which he felt was off-brand. Dixon dials up his natural boyish exuberance, imitating himself righteously marching off the plane to meet them. But Gerwig and Robbie performed the scene for him and changed his mind. When you look on the page, the nuance isn't there, the delivery isn't there, explains Robbie. Robbie had the groundwork for this with Mattel's CEO when she met with him in 2018 in the hopes that Lucky Chap could take on the Barbie project. In that very first meeting, we impressed upon Enon, we're going to honor the legacy of your brand. But if we do not acknowledge certain things, if we do not say it, someone else is going to say it, she says. So you might as well be a part of that conversation. Kreitz has hosted several pivotal meetings about Barbie at the Polo Lounge, a CNBC spot in the Beverly Hills Hotel. It is where he met Robbie for the first time, and where he invited Brenner to discuss running Mattel's film division. And so, too, Kreitz invites me, without a hint of irony, to the Polo Lounge to talk about all the other Barbie conversations that took place there. Kreitz was the fourth Mattel CEO in 4 years when he took over in 2018. He orchestrated a turnaround that included courting Hollywood's biggest talent with an exacting pitch that has proven to be persuasive. It is not about making movies so that we can go and sell more toys, he says. We've been doing well selling toys without movies. The movie does help. The day a Margot Robbie Barbie went on sale, it became the number one doll on Amazon. The most important transition was from being a toy manufacturing company that was making items to becoming an IP company that is managing franchises, he says. It is a particularly prescient strategy at a moment when superhero fatigue has set in, and studios are desperate to find new intellectual property with a built-in fan base, from Super Mario Brothers to Dungeons and Dragons. Mattel has announced 14 more movies based on its toys, including a J.J. Abrams-produced Hot Wheels movie, and intriguingly, a Barney film with Daniel Kaluuya. The expansion also includes more streaming shows, video games, and a Mattel theme park currently under construction in Arizona. From an outdoor table covered in leaves, Kreitz points out the spot where he and Robbie met. The CEO had been as eager to talk with Robbie as she had been to pursue a Barbie film. Before he hired Brenner as executive producer of Mattel Films, he asked who she thought should play the iconic doll. She, too, said Robbie. She's very funny. She's deep. She's a fantastic actress. And she does look like, Brenner pauses, she's beautiful. It is obvious why both executives zeroed in on Robbie. She looks like Barbie. Or, as the film says, she looks like stereotypical Barbie. The distinction is important. Just 8 years back, in 2015, Barbie sales had sunk to $900 million, the lowest in 25 years. So in 2016, Mattel made the biggest change to the doll since she debuted in 1959. In a Time cover story, I reported on how, after rolling out a wider array of skin tones and hair types for the dolls, Mattel launched three new body types, including Curvy Barbie. It eventually worked. Barbie sales rose and hit a record $1.7 billion in 2021, before a small industry-wide slump last year. Mattel had been toying with the idea of a Barbie movie since 2009. Big stars, Amy Schumer, Anne Hathaway, and prominent directors like Patty Jenkins were rumored to be attached before Robbie met with the company in 2018. One of the reasons Mattel resisted bringing Barbie to the big screen for so long is because the company worked hard to modernize the brand and establish that Barbie is not one body, one personality, one woman. There are currently 175 different Barbies with different combinations of body shapes, skin tones, and hair types. And yet here's Margot Robbie on the poster as the manifestation of Barbie. There is a moment in the film where Mirren makes a tongue-in-cheek joke about Robbie being too beautiful to feel insecure. Dixon argues Barbie has to look like Robbie to get audiences who have not followed Mattel's latest updates into theaters. Of course she looks like Barbie, he says, but they're all Barbie. It's the perfect cast to express what Barbie is today, and Margot is the bridge. Robbie's flattered that the Mattel execs thought of her, but she would never have wanted to play the only Barbie. If Mattel had not made that change to have a multiplicity of Barbies, I do not think I would have wanted to attempt to make a Barbie film. She says, I do not think you should say this is the one version of what Barbie is, and that is what women should aspire to be and look and act like. Issa Rae, 38, who plays President Barbie, argues the entire point of the film is to portray a world in which there is not a singular ideal. My worry was that it was going to feel too white feministy, but I think that it's self-aware, she says. Barbie Land is perfect, right? It represents perfection. So if perfection is just a bunch of white Barbies, I don't know that anybody can get on board with that. But it seems Mattel was resistant to appearing too modern. In a recent interview, Amy Schumer revealed that she left her Barbie movie because it was not feminist and cool, as she assumes Gerwig's will be. Dixon, who was in the C-suite at Mattel for other movie discussions, does not comment on Schumer but reflects on past experiences. It was a matter of finding the right talent that can appreciate the brand's authenticity and bring that controversy to life in a way that, yes, pokes fun at us but ultimately is purposeful and has heart. Still, in an interview for this story, Brenner called Gerwig's film not a feminist movie, in a sentiment echoed by other Mattel executives I spoke with. It was a striking contrast to my interpretation of the film and conversations with many of the actors who used that term unprompted to describe the script. When I relay Mattel's words to Robbie, she raises an eyebrow. Who said that? She asks, then sighs. It's not that it is or it isn't. It's a movie. It's a movie that's got so much in it. The bigger point Robbie impresses upon me is we're in on the joke. This is not a Barbie puff piece. Barbie's Corvette is not any old convertible with a slick of pink paint. If you place a doll in her car, it's too small. The windshield ends at her chest. So Gerwig insisted the life-size version must be a little small for Robbie. Barbie's vehicle was carefully created as a model and scaled up using a mathematical formula to ensure everything in Barbie Land looked toyetic. Gerwig's team built an entire neighborhood made up of dream houses that were missing walls. The actors had to be secured by wires so they would not topple off the second floors. The skies and clouds in the background were hand-painted to render a playroom-like quality, as was much of the rest of the set. From a production perspective, it's bigger than anything we've done before, says Tom Ackerley, 33, Robbie's producing partner and husband. We wanted it to feel like you could reach into the screen and touch it. Lucky Chap enlisted David Heyman, who produced the Harry Potter films, to help create this fantastical world. Gerwig jokingly nicknamed the duo Ken David and Ken Tom. Not everyone in the film has had as robust a relationship with Barbie growing up as Gerwig did. Kate McKinnon preferred to play with shells she found on the beach, or small plastic zoo animals. I did not see myself in Barbie when I was younger, she says. I saw myself in an inflatable lobster. But McKinnon, 39, watched her sister and friends play with the dolls. They cut Barbie's hair, drew on her face, even set her on fire. She theorizes they were externalizing how they felt, and they felt different. So when Gerwig offered McKinnon the role of Weird Barbie, a doll that's been played with a little too aggressively in the real world, she jumped at the chance. McKinnon was impressed by the way the script dealt with girls' complicated attachments to the doll. It comments honestly about the positive and negative feelings, she says. It's an incisive cultural critique. Alexandra Shipp, who plays an author Barbie, also projected onto the dolls as a child. Shipp, 31, wrote on Warner Brothers' Barbie Float in the West Hollywood Pride Parade this year, and reflects that Barbie helped her explore aspects of her identity. When you're a kid, your toys are an extension of who you are and how you can exist in the world as an adult, says Shipp. Sure, I had Kens, but when I played house, I had two Barbies raising a skipper. On social media, Neff, 30, published a letter she wrote to Gerwig and Robbie asking to play one of the Barbies in the film. She says that as a trans woman, she feels ambivalent about the word doll, a slang term in queer culture for trans women, particularly those who celebrate the high femme. The word can feel at once aspirational and oppressive. It's a tricky word that holds, for me anyway, such a strict standard created by the patriarchy that deserves to be scrutinized, but also a promise of liberation and safety and belonging, she says. At the very least, there's a juicy performance as a doll somewhere in there. That article has been slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.